happy. Everybody's happy now. Sex galore, but no more marriages. No one pushing baby carriages. No one has to change a nappy. Ain't we lucky, oh, ain't we happy? Everybody's happy now. Oh, dope for tea and dope for dinner. Fun all night and love and laughter. No remorse the morning after. Where's the sin and who's the sinner? Everybody's happy now. Girls pneumatic, girls exotic, girls ecstatic, girls erotic. Hug me, baby, make it snappy. Everybody's oh so happy. Everybody's happy now. Lots to eat and hours for drinking. So more cocktails and no more thinking. No more thinking. No more thinking. Oh, everybody's happy now.
And ladies and gentlemen, it's the Gnostic Media Radio Show. I'm your host, Jan Irvin, GnosticMedia.com, GnosticMedia.com. And boy, we just can't seem to get away from the topics laid forth in Aldous Huxley's twisted poem there that is the intro song to this show. Just seems the more we dig, the more pertinent that song is. And tonight I'm joined by Lennon Honor, and we're going to be discussing the importance of family, probably cover some mind control, the attacks on men and the media, etc. Lennon joined me on the Gnostic Media podcast, on September 11 or September 12 last year. So it's been almost exactly a year, and Lennon and I met in San Diego last year, probably about exactly a year ago this week, so I suppose it's good timing for all of this. And Lennon, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me on. It's good to talk with you again, and I look forward to our conversation.
Well, likewise, and this is an important subject, and I've been doing a whole series of shows. I had Curtis Duncan on discussing the feminization of men and masculinization of women with drugs in the water and food supply, etc. I had Karen Strowen on discussing feminism. And we're always bringing up, discussing the subject of families and the attack on families and sort of pushing everyone to this socialist government as parent system. And so a week or two ago, someone in the chat room mentioned you as a guest to have back on to discuss this issue. And I thought, hey, why not? I had your Skype information sitting right there in front of me, so I shot you a message. So anyway, welcome back.
Oh, my pleasure. And just for your listening audience, when we talk about relationships and family, my wife and I, we've been together for 14 years, and we have five beautiful children. So when it comes to family, I have a little experience under my belt.
Well, there you go. Well, let's see. Where should we begin here? Would you like to give out your website and your YouTube channel and any information about yourself so people can find you?
Yeah, sure. So, my name is Lennon Honor. And like I said before, I'm a husband and father. My responsibilities as a husband and father is my primary responsibilities. My website is lennonhonor.com. But if we go back maybe about 5 years ago, really, when I started the website, we're going back about eight, almost 9 years ago, I started another website, lennonhonorfilms.com. And that website is still up. It's still functional. And people can go there to get into my older works dealing with media manipulation, mind control, subliminal messages, the early works of Walt Disney, the entertainment industry, symbolism, et cetera. All that information is there. I'm also on Facebook under Lennon Honor. And I have a YouTube page, Lennon Honor Films, as well. And I've tackled a lot of different topics, from New World Order, Illuminati information, secret societies, all the way up to my current projects dealing with the entertainment industry, and in particular dealing with the West Coast rap group NWA and the particular programming there, which falls in line with what we'll be talking about here in terms of destabilization of the family unit, negative racial stereotypes about males, particular African-American males, negative male-female relationships. All that was propagandized through that particular music group. And then now they just had a biopic that just came out. In my current documentary, we'll be exposing that particular programming and propaganda. So if people want to contact me, you can always find me on Facebook and then check out my YouTube page when you have a chance, Lennon Honor Films.
All right. And so it was on September 11th when I had you on the Gnostic Media podcast. And the title of that episode was 9/11 and Cyclical Fear-Based Mind Control in the Media. And speaking of rap and music, I'm not sure if you've been catching the series on music, mind control, and psychobiology that I've been doing with Dr. Hans Utter. And for the audience, just so you know, the part three of that went out, day before yesterday, and I got the audio version up at 11:59 p.m., and I just started editing part four today of that series. And I think that would heavily overlap with your work and the one band in rap, but what we're looking at is how they're using music in general, especially rap and heavy metal and death metal for programming. But as it turns out, most music is actually a form of mind control. So that's another big thing that we've been looking at. And, why don't we dive right in here. I sent you an outline in the email. We can just kind of roughly follow that along. But do you want to start off by discussing what is the importance of family?
Oh, sure. And I just want to reflect back on my own upbringing in the household that I was raised in. It had a profound impact on me, much of which was traumatizing. I had a traumatizing childhood. My father was an alcoholic. He was a drug addict. He was abusive to my mother, abusive to us as his children. And at a certain point, he started to get on cocaine, crack cocaine. And during that time, I was about maybe 11, going to the age of 12. By the time I was 13, things had gotten so bad inside the household that, I feared for my life. I feared for my mother's life and for my siblings' life, and for good reasons. That part, my childhood in particular, had a profound impact on me, because sometimes what happens is the influence is so negative that it sets people on a negative, destructive course. Because in point of fact, when we're children, we operate based upon our subconscious mind mainly. So whatever we experience, we internalize it on some degree. What ends up happening is that once it's embedded within our subconscious mind, whatever the program is, or whatever the trauma is for that matter, it will have a level of impact in terms of our thoughts, our behavior modification. So some of us, we're able to... So for some of us, we end up moving in paths and in directions that are not necessarily positive and healthy in our life because of those childhood experiences. But then there are some of us who we are able to, for whatever reason, overcome that particular type of programming. And then we recognize why it's important to do something different. So in my case, growing up, we never had a stable family unit. And so therefore, as a result, I was exposed to things. My siblings were exposed to things, traumatizing events, individuals, situations and circumstances that could have totally been avoided. Also, additionally, in terms of our family dynamic, we weren't necessarily raised to properly love or to properly think critically about things. And I think this is something that many people can relate to. Your gift. You're able to ask the critical questions about the nature of reality and degrees of manipulation that's out there. But these are all things that our parents should be teaching us from birth. Many of us, we get on this journey, and then we're 21, 25, 30, in some cases 40. Then we start to ask those critical questions. In my childhood, we were not raised that way. So the importance of family is that it really is the seed through which you can prepare the next generation to reach beyond the previous generation's paradigm. And if, in fact, the previous generation's paradigm was one of self-destruction, was one of abuse, was one of trauma, was one of capitulation to authority, okay, then the notion of us transcending that through the next generation is empowering, because what it shows is, as a species, we do have the power to raise the next generation up in such a way that the next generation will be more empowered to experience a greater life experience. Some of us, we don't get to that point until we're 30, 35, 40, but the nature and the power of family is that you can actually begin to raise children from conception, in point of fact. so that they can get on that path much earlier on. And just imagine if that was taking place around the globe, and we had people who were being raised to be critical thinkers, who were being raised to question authority to such a degree to where they always seek truth no matter what. Where will we be at as a species today? And the family institution is the primary source, and it should be the primary source of that type of transformative experience. And that's why the family is so very important.
Well, I agree with you on that, and I went through some similar stuff as a child with family, and really wasn't taught the tools of critical thinking, et cetera. You know, and they, you know, I was thrown in a private school through second grade, and then went into public schools after that when my parents got divorced. But I don't really remember my father ever teaching me that many critical skills. I remember him learning to, or teaching me to shoot a gun. I mean, even my grandmother bought me my first knife and all of this stuff, things that fathers are really supposed to do and teach their children. But my father was pretty abusive, did lots of crazy things. I don't want to get into too much depth on it, but basically the same sort of thing going on there. But looking back and looking at how I was raised versus how I raised my son, it's like night and day. You know, my father, he was of the generation where children are to be seen and not heard. When something was told to a child, you weren't to question it to understand it. It was because I said so.
Yes.
And so rather than, you know, sitting down, well, you know, it's because of this and these things, and so I need you to understand all of these so that you can understand why. It was just because I said so. So, you know, it really deprives the child of this learning opportunity. So I've always avoided those things with my own son and, you know, try to focus on providing a sound explanation, providing sound reasoning. And as you are probably aware, I run the triviumeducation.com website, which is all about giving critical thinking and the proper tools of critical thinking to always focus on truth, finding truth, building the self-esteem back up, and not taking things just because some authority, including parents, tells us so. So, you know, that is very important in my opinion, in most people's opinion, to, you know, provide the critical thinking, to provide a solid foundation. And so anyway, we'll get into more of this as we go through, but do you still talk to your father?
Not consistently. It's interesting that you bring that up. My mother, she's been consistent in my life from the beginning, and I really respect her for that. We may not necessarily agree on everything, but she has been a positive force in my life throughout my life. My father, on the other hand, at the age of 13, he was out of the home, and he has been inconsistent in my life and in my siblings' life, but also in his grandchildren's life as well. This past Father's Day, I always call my music teacher, James Newton, who was like a father figure to me from the age of 16 until about the age of 25. And so I called him for Father's Day, and I brought up my father, and I thanked him. I thanked James for, you know, being there so that I had someone to call. And he said, you know, no problem. I said, yeah, I wish I could call my own father. He says, well, you know, give your father a call. If it was anyone else, I would not. If anyone else had asked me to do that, I would not have done it. Save for my wife. If my wife had asked me to do it, I would have done it. But anyone else, I would have said no. But because it was James, I said, okay, I'm going to go ahead and do that. He said, you give him a call. It doesn't matter how it resonates with him. You always be the bigger man, and let this be the last, your last attempt, because I've tried so many times to reconcile with my father. So I called my father. We talked for about 3 minutes. It was very uncomfortable. He was uncomfortable. and then he said, and I hadn't talked with him for about 2.5 years before that. And then before that other time, it probably had been about 2 years. He said, I'll call you back. I have to take a shower. So we got off the phone, and he said, he'll call me back the following day. He didn't call me back. A week passed. He doesn't call me. 2 weeks passed. He didn't call me. And then I think it was about a week and a half ago, he called me. And he had just gotten out of the hospital again because he's not in good health. And that's the thing. My father has this program where he only reaches out when he needs something or when he's in the hospital, when he's in really bad physical condition. And he wants me to console him, or he wants some of his children to come and support him, that kind of thing. But that's not the foundation of a relationship between father and son, or father and daughter for that matter. So I have gotten to the point now, because I have a family to take care of, I don't really have time to run after a male who simply does not care enough to be part of his son's life or to be part of his grandchildren's life. I don't really have time for that, but I am open. If my father wanted to call me today, it's not like I would avoid him, but the notion of me continuing to, express outwardly all of this energy and focus all this energy towards connecting and reconciling with my father is dysfunctional, because I have a family to take care of. And I think that's part of the transcendence into manhood, is to recognize that you have your childhood family, and it had its place. That includes your mother, your father, your siblings. But then you have your adulthood family, which includes your wife and your children. And your adulthood family is what takes precedence. And anything that takes away from your ability to be the best husband and father that you can be for your adulthood family's interests, it should be avoided. And that may also include letting go of people, which may also include your father. In some cases, it may include your mother. So at this point, we don't have a positive relationship. My father and I, it's never been consistent. And to be quite honest with you, we never really had a positive, consistent relationship.
Yeah, that's very similar to mine, and maybe even then some. But, I've heard from my father twice, I guess, in the last 4 or 5 years. And once, because he landed in the hospital with a brain aneurysm. And he had my ex-wife call me to tell me that he was in the hospital. And then another time, the last time, he had my uncle call me to inform me that my grandmother had died, when I was the last one to go and see her in the hospital. And actually, I was pretty much the only one going to visit her in the hospital. And so he had my uncle call me like a week after she died, but I was there seeing her, and I had already known all this stuff going on the day before she died. And I was making sure to go see her regularly while she was, in convalescence. So it's a very similar situation. I don't try to reach out to the guy anymore at all. I mean, he's, he's got a lot of issues and stuff, but he's never shown, just like your father, any importance towards his family and children and things like that. And when I was 9, my father remarried and pretty much just forgot about my sister and I after that point. And from then on, he was pretty much just traveling around the world, 3 months in Australia, a month in New Zealand, a month in Siberia, a month over here, a month over there, that type, or, you know, up in Northern Canada doing the Iditarod or something like this. So he always had stuff to do, but it was never family related. And if he did come around when I was a kid, it was sort of like the Disneyland dad sort of thing. I remember him taking me to Knott's Berry Farm once, and maybe to Disneyland once when I was in about third grade. I remember a few things with him, but, you know, for the most part, the guy was absent, growing up. And, always putting his business first rather than family. But what's interesting is, if he had the proper focus, he could have done business and family. But,
yes,
you
that's
know,
right.
Mm-hmm. It's, you know, it's just a placement of priorities. So how do we raise our relationship standards?
Yes, in relationship standards, that is the standard that people set in terms of the types of relationships that they establish. And in particular, it can be relationships with anyone. It can be relationships with your parents. It can be relationships with your siblings, relationships with other family members. But in particular, relationships that we establish in terms of male-female relationships, when we are in the process of at least considering, a potential partner for a long-term relationship that may also at some point materialize children. We tend to set very low standards. I'm just saying, people in general, we tend to set very low standards for relationships. And I think part of the reason why is because we tend not to see a lot of positive relationships. So as children, that we tend to operate.
You're going to have to hold that thought. We have a break here.
Oh, okay. Yeah, sure.
All right. We'll be right back. All right, we're back. Where were we, Lennon? I had just asked you about how do we raise our relationship standards? And I asked you that about 30 seconds before the commercial break. So
that's okay. Yeah, so relationship standards are important. In other words, the standards that you set, the expectations that you set for proper relationships. There are people who they accept negative relationships as being positive, and they experience all of the trauma of being in that type of a relationship, and they may accept all the trauma and the abuse as expressions of love, but that's because the standards that they set into the relationships are so low. I was going to say that one of the reasons why we tend to set low standards is because we don't necessarily see very positive standards being set in terms of those that are, who are around us. So that could be like our mother's relationship to our father. It can be the cousins around us, our friends. It could be neighbors. It could be other relatives, aunts and uncles. Even in my own experience, it's very difficult for me to find, you know, more than like maybe three or four people that I've met, especially in my childhood, who were in positive male-female relationships. So in the absence of seeing a lot of examples, we may see all of the destructive ones, you know, the abusive relationships, emotionally abusive, verbally abusive, infidelity in the relationships, there's cheating, there's different levels of abuse, the relationship is negative on many different levels. And then we may begin to take that as the standardized norm, because as children, we tend to incorporate whatever we're seeing without much critical thought, unless we're taught to think critically. But we accept it, and it is embedded within our subconscious mind. And later on, we begin to think it impacts our psychology. We begin to think that is the norm, that becomes the standard. And so therefore, in general, people tend to have very low standards for relationships. And as a consequence, people tend to suffer in relationships, because if you have a very low standard, then what you're going to experience in that type of relationship is a lot of negativity, toxicity, and abuse. And that's why a lot of people tend to suffer in male-female relationships. And that's precisely why my wife and I, we're very big on this. It's important for us to begin to raise our relationship standards, because the standards that you set will be directly related to the experiences that you have. All relationships are based upon the value that you place upon yourself. If you have a high level of value for yourself, you're going to set a high standard. If you have a low value for yourself, you're going to set a low standard. And as a consequence, you will suffer in that particular relationship. That's why we have to, in the first place, deal with the value that we place upon ourselves as human beings, but then also raise our relationship standards as a consequence.
All right. What are men and women at war? And is that an artificial outside influence as well?
That is artificially implanted. In other words, I have this concept that I work with. I've been talking about it for years. The male versus female war imprint program. Male versus female war imprint program. We tend to be raised to be at war with each other. We tend, as men and women, as boys and girls, for that matter, we tend to be raised to think that somehow men are to be separate from women, and that women are to be separate from men. It doesn't mean we shouldn't be separate. It doesn't mean that we're not different. That we shouldn't be different, because we are definitely different. But the notion of us being separate, the notion of us being in competition, the notion of us struggling and vying for control and power, the notion of us being at war with each other is a program that many of us have received. So if you can imagine, if we received the male versus female war imprint program, with a lot of it, again, media driven, a lot of it is just familiar, meaning the types of dynamics that we see in our own family institutions, father and mother, it's friends. They live out this particular program. When we are experiencing the male versus female war imprint program, how does that impact the probability of us experiencing a positive relationship with a woman as a man, or a positive relationship with a man as a woman? It's going to have a very detrimental effect. So one of the things I always propose for men and women to do is to look at the programs that they're running. If you're running this program of male versus female war imprint program, a lot of that too is instilled in us in the public education system. Boys are yucky, girls are yucky, men are from Mars, or whatever they say, these types of dynamics. Well, this is all about separation. Again, we can be different than each other, but the notion of us needing to be separate and there to be this stringent division between each other is counterproductive. So one of the things my wife and I, we encourage people to do is that if you do have this particular program, if you say things like there are no good men out there, there's no good women out there, all men are this way, all women are that way, if you have these negative thoughts about your species half, you're probably running the male versus female war imprint program. And if you're at war with men as women, or if you're at war with women as men, you can't expect to establish a positive male-female relationship. It's simply impossible.
You know, and we might as well segue for a moment here. Are you familiar with the work of Karen Strouin?
No.
Okay, she runs the Girl Writes What channel on YouTube, and she has spent years exposing feminism. And, of course, Gloria Steinem was actually working for the CIA. But I'll read you a quote about Gloria Steinem when we get back, and we can cover more of this. We'll be right back.
Hours for drinking, so my cocktails, and no more thinking, no more thinking, no more thinking. Oh, everybody's happy now.
And we're back. And I was discussing Karen Strouin before the break. And this quote, this is actually from Director of Central Intelligence, William Colby, and he's quoting Gloria Steinem, and he says, quote, "I might quote Miss Gloria Steinem, one of those so assisted, who commented that the CIA wanted to do what we wanted to do, present a healthy, diverse view of the United States. Never felt I was being dictated to at all," he's quoting her. And, you know, so this healthy, diverse view of the United States that Steinem and these CIA psychopaths were promoting was the destruction of the family and nudging everyone along to this socialist structure. Because obviously with a strong family, you're not going to be reliant upon the government. But a single mom, you know, if she's taken support checks from the government, et cetera, she's not going to be willing to resist against this you know, this government and all of this mind control stuff that's going on right now. And she's going to stay within that. But within a family, you don't need the government. In fact, with an extended family, with the aunts, uncles, grandparents, and cousins around, you can actually, you know, you don't really even notice the government's going by. And with extended family, governments can rise and fall, and the extended family still survive. So this is obviously, in my opinion, one of the key reasons why they're attacking the family. This is one of the reasons why extended families are pretty much gone in all of the current and former British colonies. And it's, you know, if we go into the Spanish colonies, into South America, etc., we still see the extended family. We still see it throughout Central and Eastern Europe, etc. But in the former British colonies, we see the annihilation of the extended family. We saw in the 1920s through the 30s that they would only give home loans to nuclear families. So this is, you know, impacted constantly, this. And then, of course, we see the women's liberation movement promoted by con artists like Gloria Steinem to further separate, you know, we're going to liberate the women. You know, meanwhile, the men had to go into these factories, et cetera, to provide for the family. But somehow the women who didn't have to work, who, you know, were able to stay at home, who didn't have to pay taxes, they were the ones somehow that got suppressed. And the men who had to go off and fight and die, the men who are the first to go down with the ship, et cetera, they were somehow suppressing the women and everyone else. So this, you know, just goes to show the, you know, the utter nonsense that, you know, the CIA and their shills promote with this so-called diverse view that they were promoting and currently are promoting with the destruction of gender and everything else.
Yeah, well, it's a great challenge, but it's also more incentive for people to really look deeper into the types of relationships that they're establishing. And you brought up a good point, a very important point earlier on, that the dependency on the state, one's dependency on the state will always be directly related to the degree to which they can either count on or not count on their own family members. Okay, so that can be, you know, the nuclear family, that can also be the extended family. You'll find that people who do not have the type of network within their family structure, a positive network, they will tend to be more dependent on the state. Okay, so we can use the example of a mother who doesn't have the support of the father of the children. Therefore, her dependency on the state will probably be a lot more than what it would have been if the father of her children was in the home and functioning as a dedicated husband and committed father. So if you can destabilize the family, then what ends up happening is not only are adults now more subject to the state, but their progeny, the children who are born under those dynamics, they also now need to become more under the watchful eye, if you will, of the state. Example of that is my wife and I, we homeschool our children. Our children, they have very little interaction. Well, actually, they have no interaction with the state. But that is because with our family, our cohesion, we're such a cohesive force that we're able to do things that most other people are unable to do, especially those folk who are in negative toxic relationships. It's more difficult for someone to do something like that, to homeschool, to home birth, to do these types of things when the nature of their relationship may not necessarily be as firm as it could be. And I'm saying the relationship in terms of their partner, but also the family dynamics as well. The point is that you will find that individuals who are able to establish healthy family institutions tend to be less dependent on the state, whereas people who have dysfunctional families, for whatever reason, tend to be more reliant on the state. And that's a serious problem. But in fact, to have your children in the public education system, that is a form of state dependency. You're dependent on the state to educate your children. If you want to say it's a good thing, you want to say it's a bad thing, that's not the point. The point is that once you do have a cohesive family unit, and if you do, in point of fact, want to do something like homeschool, if you have that cohesive family unit, it makes it a whole lot easier. In the absence of having that positive relationship, in the absence of having that healthy family institution, and then a network of family members who would support you, it becomes a lot more difficult. So this, again, is another example in terms of the state dependency. Oftentimes what happens is the way that the system is set up, we're set on course to be dependent on the state from birth. And therefore, as a consequence, we tend not to think outside of that very limiting box.
Well, exactly. And it becomes what I call extended adolescence. Essentially, the state becomes mommy and daddy. So then rather than learning to be self-proficient and self-sufficient, you know, you're reliant upon the state. The state is going to take care of my medical needs. The state is going to take care of my retirement. The state is going to do this. The state is going to do that. The state is going to feed my children and give me food stamps. And then what happens is that money has to be stolen from the real families out there, which further pushes down the real families and destroys the whole system until it eventually totally collapses. Or you end up in some Ray Kurzweilian transhumanist nightmare. And so, it's very important that people understand the importance of family and extended family. And I remember when I first traveled to Europe and South America, et cetera, and seeing these extended families, I was, you know, it kind of freaked me out for the first week or so because I had no time to myself whatsoever. There was always somebody around, and I was never used to that. I mean, you know, when I was 17, I was still a junior in high school. I would, you know, my parents told me, get out, you know, go get your own apartment. And so, from the time I was a junior in high school, I was on my own and I had, you know, private time and, of course, partying and irresponsibility abounded from there. But, you see all of this and, you know, what happens when the extended family is not there? So first what happens is, so the mom is going to be there. She can still do a lot of the things, but without the extended family, if the mom needed to go out to work or bring in extra funds, the extended family isn't there to watch the children. So then in comes latchkey on top of the socialist school system that, educates the children instead of homeschooling. And homeschooling repeatedly shows children doing far better, exceeding far better than people in compulsory education. But anyway, all of this stuff goes to get people inch by inch further and further into this socialist communist nightmare. And, you know, and I have people write me, well, you know, I'm from England and I think socialism is good and they do some good things. And it's like, really? Well, where? I mean, if you had the extended family, if you were working for a real future, if you had your cows, your ducks, your chickens and your pigs and your garden and the rest around you, what would you need of that? I mean, you know, it's okay, we can volunteer to help build a road or, you know, something like that. And, you know, the issue is, and Clint Richardson's exposed a lot of this, and the government that we're seeing now is far and removed from any sort of lawful government that we're supposed to have. We're all under the color of law right now. But if we actually were looking at a real workable system, it wouldn't be all of this social and everybody crying for mommy and daddy government to come and rescue them for every little thing that comes around.
Yes. But again, I think it goes back to this issue of establishing positive male-female relationships. The dependency on the state will be minimized.
Right.
There's other ways of looking at this too. What came to mind is the notion that we are to hand our children over to the state to be educated. I mean, how many people actually question that notion?
Not very many. And then you see them bringing in this Common Core nonsense where they want to teach every child the same thing in the entire world at the same time. And, you know, it stifles children's curiosity. I see it dramatically. You know, and my ex, she pulled some stunts and used that I wanted to homeschool our son. She pulled that up in the court to actually try and take custody. So she's got him wrapped up in the government school system against all of our prior agreements and everything else. And I've had to pull him out of certain teachers' classrooms, et cetera, because of the nonsense. You know, and he had a teacher that wouldn't let him have recess for like a month or 6 weeks. And I raised hell about it and finally got him out of that teacher's classroom. And she's, you know, he's disrupting the class and causing all kinds of trouble. The second we got him out of that teacher's classroom, which was almost 2 years ago, he never got in trouble again. Mm. And, you know, it was this specific teacher, and she was this feminist, communist, Common Core pushing, you know, nut job. And, you know, my son was a little bit too independent-minded, so, you know, her punishment against a second grader was to not allow him to have recess for a month and a half. In fact, it impacted him so much that in third grade, his teacher had to tell him for several weeks in a row that it was okay for him to go out to recess. He was actually afraid a year later to have recess. Mm. You still there?
Yeah, I'm there. Well, that just goes to show you. There's a lot more, I think, that people should consider. And it's not to say that the public education system is all bad, but if a person does not even consider the possibility of homeschooling, I think that speaks to a deeper issue. We have been so entrained to externalize our power, and in particular onto the state, that we don't even question it. We should at least question it. That's all I'm saying. And it's not for everyone, too. I should mention, homeschooling is not for everyone. Home birthing is not for everyone. You really have to be in a very specific type of a situation in order for that to materialize, because the system is set up in point of fact so that that does not materialize. So for those who are able to, I encourage them to do or to at least consider that as an option, whether that's homeschooling or home birthing. The problem is that we have been so conditioned and trained that we don't even question it. It's not even something that we question. Some cases, our children are in the public education system for whatever reason, and they may be having difficult times in the public education system, but we don't even question that. The teacher says the child is doing something wrong, we don't question anything about the teacher. We don't question anything about how that particular classroom is run or how it's not being run properly.
Right.
Again, these are all things that we should be considering.
Well, and look at this level, Lennon. Okay, so you have all of these children who, instead of a real breakfast in the morning, they're fed cereal with loads of wheat and sugar, and now they're promoting low-fat milk as well. And so then they say that the children have attention deficit disorder. And meanwhile, two slices of bread has as much sugar as is equivalent to a tablespoon of sugar. And you have the sugar on top of the sugar wheat, and then the low-fat, you know, dairy. Their brains don't have the nutrition. And then they can, you know, oh, your children are acting up, your children are doing this, your children are doing that. You know, and the first thing to, you know, to have children behave well is diet and nutrition, having enough fat in the diet. You know, wake up, cook your children eggs for breakfast, eggs, bacon, sausage, whatever, you know, cook them a real meal. Go through the cupboards, throw out the cereal, the sugar crap, all of that stuff. That's poisoning them. That's actually one of the key ways that they're committing eugenics against the population, is with this stuff. And it keeps, you know, the children sick and inflamed and, you know, unable to sit still and unable to relax. And when I have gone on field trips, let's say with my son's class or whatever, to the local museum, you know, there was a couple of kids who would eat cereal every morning for breakfast. And I just asked this one of the kids, you eat cereal for breakfast, you know, you ate cereal for breakfast this morning, didn't you? He said, yeah, of course, I love cereal. And I said, that's what I thought, you know, because he was completely out of control. And the teacher and the moms put this boy over to me to, you know, to keep him under control a little bit. because he was just so out of control from the diet. But I could see that, you know, he wasn't a bad kid like they all thought. It was, you know, he was getting a bad diet.
Yeah, that does have an impact, too. Most definitely. You really have to have your children in the right mental state. And the right mental state also incorporates internal chemistry. The mental state, the mind has to have the appropriate type of chemical balance, and the body has to have the appropriate type of chemical balance in order to function appropriately. So if your children are not eating the appropriate types of foods, then it's going to be very difficult for them to have the appropriate internal chemistry that would put them in a position to where proper intellectual process and critical thinking can be set in motion. So that also plays a heavy role in terms of a child's ability to function intellectually, whether that's in the school system or otherwise. One thing that came to mind just now is whenever I go to the store, this is how it used to be. They change things around inside the store that's down the street. But before, all of the drinking water, that section was right next to the candy section. So they're really in the same aisle. On the left-hand side is all the candy. On the right-hand side, there's the drinking water. Whenever I would go to get drinking water, not every single time, but most of the time, that's a section where there would be children, you know, parents with their children, they would be going there to that section to get the candy. And what would happen is that when the children would walk into that section, they look to their right, they don't have any kind of physiological response or even an emotional response. But then when they would look to the left and see the candy, they wouldn't even, you know, it's just the candy wrappers. All of a sudden, they begin to have this reaction. You know, it's an emotional reaction. It's a physiological reaction. And they become very animated because they're addicted to the sugar. Now, they're not actually consuming it, but just the sight of it. Now, even if the parent doesn't buy them anything at that point, when you check out, they always have the candy right there, you know, at the checkout, right when you check out. And the idea is, in terms of consumerism, that you want people to choose emotionally. It's the last thing that you can get, so you better go ahead and get it. And you see that parents at that point, that's when they go ahead and get that type of food or that candy for the children. Again, candy does not facilitate proper intellectual process. It actually compromises intellectual process. When my children walk through that section, they don't have that type of a response. And the reason why is because they have not eaten candy.
I agree. You know, and my son saw someone who had a heart attack in 2010, and I took him to the hospital, you know, while I was there visiting, and he saw the person in the hospital just after surgery, chest all cut open. I said, see, this is what sugar and wheat and all of this stuff does, you know, and I've always taught my son to, you know, think without the emotions, you know, put the emotions in the slime jar. You know, they have those kits where the kids can put the little balls in water, and then they turn into slime and stuff. So I always told him, you know, just put your emotions in the slime jar and think without those. Think critically about what you're doing. So every once in a long while, he'll ask me for a piece of candy, but he never asked me in a store or anything like that. And I think I hear the bumper music. Yep, and we'll be right back. All right, Lennon, why don't we touch on separation and divorce here? How do we prepare children, if we're in a negative relationship, how do we prepare children for separation and or divorce?
Yeah, that's an important topic. And recently I did a video on that particular topic. I tend to have people send me emails, and they may be in a situation. I do personal consultations too, but in some cases people send me emails about their situation. And if I have the time, and if it's a pressing issue, I take the time to do a video for them. And that's one of the recent videos, this issue of preparing children for separation when the parents need to separate, or when the parents need to divorce for that matter. And in that video, I give specific things that parents can do to prepare for, the child for that experience. And one of the things is simply to have open dialogue with the child, age-appropriate dialogue, so the child understands why it's necessary, if it is in point of fact necessary, to separate, or why it is necessary to divorce. One of the things that happens is that in the absence of that level of preparation, this, you know, intelligent conversations about the need for divorce or the need for separation, children can begin to think that somehow it's their fault, and that somehow it's something that they did, and they're the reason why mommy and daddy are separating, and they're the reason why mommy and daddy are planning on divorcing. And that can hold profound implications in terms of the child's psychological and emotional development. It can also function as a degree of traumatization for the child that makes it even more difficult for the parents later on to co-parent if they do, in point of fact, separate, or if they, in point of fact, divorce. So that's one of the things that I talk about in that particular video. And I give a whole slew of other things that a person can do, a parent should do for their children in order to prepare them for that particular experience.
All right, we have about 2 minutes here before the next break. Why don't we switch gears and start discussing proving love?
Yes. This is an interesting topic because a lot of the programming that we get, especially in media, we can look at Disney films like Disney Princess programming.
I bring that up all the time.
you can always bring that up. It's very dysfunctional. It's very dysfunctional. And there are men and women, well, let's say women in particular, who believe that somehow if they're in an abusive relationship, Beauty and the Beast comes to mind. If they're in an abusive relationship, then somehow it's okay. They have to figure out a way to endure and get through it, because by enduring it and getting through it, they're proving their love. And I'm very clear that love has nothing to do with pain and suffering to that magnitude. It really has nothing to do with that. But if you're programmed that way, and if women in particular, if you're programmed to believe that somehow the way that you prove your love for a man is to allow him to abuse you, then you really have to take a critical look at your own psychology. Similarly, there are men who believe that somehow to be in a relationship and it needs to be difficult, and what proves your love is you staying in this negative, toxic relationship. That doesn't prove love. What it proves is that you're in a dysfunctional relationship.
Right. Now, and go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to add that, and men can be just as often be in an abusive, in a relationship with an abusive woman. So we shouldn't just say, it's only men that are abusive, because actually statistically, women, while they may not have the physical size, they can often be just as abusive, if not more so, and mentally speaking as well.
Yeah, and verbally. So there's different levels of abuse. Of course, there are different levels of abuse, but you're absolutely right. It's not that only one half of the species experience those levels of abuse. I mean, we tend to abuse each other. And what I was getting at was that the notion that in order to prove that you love someone is to endure that abuse, whether you're a man or a woman, is a bankrupt notion. What that proves is that you don't value yourself as a human being enough to recognize that you're undeserving of that type of treatment. It also proves that the relationship is not a positive one. When you're in a positive relationship, what you will see is a loving experience, and that proves the loving experience is what proves that you are, in point of fact, in love, or in this, you're having this loving experience. So this is one of the dynamics that we have to be critical about in relationships, because oftentimes we accept negative relationships.
All right, that's the bumper music. So hold that thought, and we'll be right back.
Lots to eat and hours for drinking, so more cocktails and no more thinking, no more thinking. Everybody's oh so happy.
Okay. So we were just discussing, I think we were discussing proving love still. Did you, I think you were still saying something when we went to break there. Did you want to finish that up?
Oh, no, I got through it. I think I was able to finish.
Yeah. All right. Are you interested in taking calls? I know we have a lot left to cover here, but did you want to
Sure. That's fine. Or if there's any, comments or questions in the chat room, that's fine.
Sure. All right. Well, 800-313-9443 if you have any questions for Lennon. Again, 800-313-9443. And so why don't we discuss for a moment, how does one go about finding a proper mate?
Yes. That's another thing that really, this is information that our parents should be sharing with us. They should be talking with us about, they should be talking with us about how to select the appropriate partner, what to look for. And it can be a little bit different too. For men, it should be a little bit different what you're looking for in a potential partner. There's some basic things I think that go both ways, but then there are also very specific things that men should be looking for, and there's very specific things that women should be looking for. And point of fact, a lot of the programming out there is to kind of skew these gender needs. So in other words, that there are specific needs that the male gender has, or that the male gender will have, and there are specific needs that the female gender will have. And when you do not take into consideration these differences, then someone is going to be left unfulfilled in relationships. But the point that I was getting at was that it's important that the information is passed down to men young men and young women in terms of what they should be looking for and how to go about the process of preparing for a positive relationship. And one of the first things that my wife and I, we always tell people, is just like with anything else. Okay, Jan, you know this to be the case. You're a researcher. You're independent research. The amount of time that you put into researching far outweighs what most people will in a month, far outweighs the amount of research that most people do in their lifetime. Now, if we're willing to put forth that type of research into any other area of our life, then why don't we put the same type of research into the potential partner that we may be seeking to spend the rest of our life with, or maybe even have children with? So we should really be engaging this relationship experience or potential relationship experience from the vantage point of researchers, men and women. You should be, the first thing that you do is you research your potential partner. Get as much information. Some of that information is you ask other people who know them, you ask them. And in most cases, you should be able to ask them critical questions, direct questions. As men and women, you should be able to ask these critical questions. The problem is that we don't do enough research in the end. And so we may have a thesis that we kind of think we believe to be true, but because we didn't do the research, what ends up happening is we commit to this relationship, we initialize the thesis, but then we find out the thesis was wrong in the end. Because we didn't do the proper research. We didn't get the information that we need that would prove the thesis to be true in advance of actually selecting the relationship. So in other words, to take it out of the scope of research, when it comes to relationships, we have to prepare ourselves with information. It's about information gathering. We have to not only know our partner, but we also have to know ourselves. We have to know what we want in a relationship. We have to know whether or not our partner is going to be able to bring to the table what we need them to bring to the table, and that we're going to bring to the table what they need to bring to what we need to bring to the table for them. That makes sense. So what I'm saying is the key issue is information. The foundation of a healthy, positive relationship is information. That should be the first step. Now, what happens for most people is that we do not take the time to do the research and study. We don't study our partner. We don't know ourselves. And we tend to rush into relationships for various reasons. Sometimes it's hormonal. You know, sometimes it's just sexual. We have these sexual needs, so we want to rush in. Sometimes it's just an issue of being lonely. None of these things are good reasons to establish a relationship with someone. And so in the absence of actually doing research on this person, we jump into this relationship and maybe everything seems fine for like a month, maybe 2 months, maybe three, but then the truth starts to reveal itself and then we realize that we made a bad choice. So most of us, we've had relationships that have failed, and the primary reason why those relationships failed was not just because maybe the person that we were dealing with wasn't the appropriate partner, but because we didn't do the research on the front end so that we made the appropriate choice in a partner in the first place. This makes a huge difference because it takes us out of the scope of being these victims, victimized by other people, and we place the power in our own hands. And the power comes from knowledge, information, getting information that will empower you to make the best choice. So the first thing I always tell people, my wife always, we tell people, you got to do the research. You have to know thyself, but then also know your potential partner prior to choosing to commit to a relationship. And of course, prior to engaging in any level of sexual activity.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I would add another layer to that. You know, not only do you do this research, but you need the critical thinking skills. You're dealing with love, which is an emotional topic, and the emotions, going back to the reference to my son in the slime jar, the emotions need to go in that slime jar while you're looking at all of this information. And, you know, I saw one of your videos where with this woman, she was dating this guy for 2.5 years, and he was married in a relationship and blowing her all this steam. But, you know, if we see all of these contradictions and all of these things, what happens is the emotions take over and we refuse to look at the facts. So if we can put the emotions in that slime jar, whatever you want to make up for yourself, and just deal with the information and not think with fallacies. You know, this person is, he's using an appeal, or she is using an appeal to emotion, etc. And, avoiding these specific topics, or there are contradictions. Well, you know, ladies and gentlemen, a contradiction is a sign of a lie or an error in that research or information. When you see that contradiction, you investigate it. You need to ask questions. And if you're in a relationship, you know, deal with it nicely and politely. Don't leap to false assumptions. It may be that you created the contradiction by not having enough information on that specific situation or whatever. But, you know, it's key, do the research, get that grammar, that who, what, where, and when, and then filter those fallacies, the why aspect. That's the logic part. Why is this happening? Why am I in this relationship? You know, and then we can look at all of the data that we've gathered and think clearly about it, and then understand why we do or don't want to be in that particular relationship.
Yes, and it has to be an intellectual process. Relationships should be an intellectual process. Most of us, we weren't trained that way. We were trained to what we feel. But see, oftentimes what we feel is not an indicator of reality. The other thing is that if you have any level of emotional trauma from childhood, your feelings are going to deceive you one way or the other. Unless you have engaged in the healing process, unless you engage in some level of personal healing in terms of the traumatization. So in other words, if you choose based upon feelings and your feelings have been hurt for most of your life, then your decisions are also going to bring you hurt. So that's why the intellectual part is key. Your intellect will not lie to you. You got to, again, who, what, where, why, when, how. You ask these critical questions. Is this functional? Is this the type of person that is going to be complementary to me? What are, or do we have similar goals in mind in life? What are our goals? Do we have similar goals in life? These are all critical questions that we should be asking. We spend more time asking questions about the type of car that we may purchase or the home that we may seek to buy, a mortgage or what have you. But when it comes to relationship, we tend not to ask the critical question. Why is that the case? Well, the reason for most of us is because we don't associate relationships with intellect. We tend to associate relationships with emotions. And again, if your emotions have been damaged, especially as a child, your emotions will fool you one way or the other until such time that you engage in the healing process. So that's why my wife and I, again, we tell people the number one thing that a person, anyone can do, man or woman, to prepare for a positive relationship is to heal from past relationships. That's number one. But then once you heal from past relationships, you need to go transcend the scope from the vantage point of looking at things from strictly emotions, but then begin to also to look at things from the intellect. And it's not that you deny your emotions, but what I'm saying is that if you want different results, you can't keep doing what you've done before. What we have been trained to do, especially when coming up and learning about relationships, is to go based upon emotions. So one day I love him and he loves me. A week later, I don't. Okay, that's not intellect. That's not intellect based. Okay, that's emotion driven. And we tend to hold on to that childlike mentality about relationships. And then we wonder why later on in life we tend to fail and miserably in relationships over and over again. You got to do something different. And I will propose that one of the most important things that people can do differently in terms of their selection process is start to really think critically about the choices that they are making. It will make a huge difference.
I agree, you know, and something else is, you know, can you and your spouse, your potential mate, plan and see things 5, 10, 20 years out? And are you focused on those same goals together? I mean, you might be doing different things, but, you know, at the end result, you should be focused on the same long-term goals together, and then you can work together building that future together, and then you can have a, you know, a much nicer life together working and achieving those goals. If your goals are not in line, you probably need to get out. Or if one of the two people can't see past next week or next month or next year, you know, guess what? It's a bad relationship and you need to get out.
Yes, absolutely. My wife and I, we have a saying, you either grow together, you grow apart. And that's why you always have to assess where you are going collectively. And if you're not going in the same direction, then you're probably setting yourself up for failure in that particular relationship. But again, if you choose wisely on the front end, then the probability of something like that happening statistically, it's greatly diminished. It's greatly decreased. But you have to make the appropriate choice on the front end. And I can say with my wife, we really did take the time to get to know each other. We took the time to research each other. The most important thing I've done in my life was research my wife. Okay. Did the appropriate amount of research. And as a consequence, we've had the benefit of being in a positive relationship for the last 14 years and steadily growing together, about 5 beautiful children. But if I had chosen based upon emotions, then I probably would not have established a positive relationship with my wife. And as a consequence, I wouldn't have all the, you know, wonderful things that I do have in my life in terms of male-female relationships and a healthy family institution. But it all goes back to proper intellectual process. We should really think about relationships intelligently. The same amount of time and research that we put into other things, we should put at least a double when it comes to choosing a potential partner.
All right. Let's define what is a negative relationship.
Yes, and that's another thing. We have to know what is a positive relationship and what's a negative relationship.
Indeed.
Yes, relationships really have to do with a interaction that you have with someone or something, because it doesn't necessarily have to be a person. You can have a relationship to, I don't know, if you sleep a lot, you probably have a relationship to your bed. It means something to you and your pillow. Okay. There's a relationship there. If you have animals, you probably have a certain type of relationship to your animal. If there's a certain type of food that you really enjoy, you probably have a certain type of relationship. But you can ask the question whether or not it's positive or negative. Same thing applies to male-female relationships. In this case, we're talking about a man and a woman who are committing themselves to being with each other. And many of us, when we get into relationships, we have no idea, you know, what is a positive relationship and what is a negative one. So let me tell you, a negative relationship ultimately is going to bring suffering into your life. And the suffering, and not only will it bring suffering, but it will be consistent suffering. Okay, that could be emotional distress, that could be physical distress, that could be a negative experience, different levels of abuse, verbal abuse, physical abuse, emotional abuse. The negativity and the pain and the harm that comes unto you because you're in that relationship will be consistent. Okay, that's how you can define a negative relationship. So if you're unhappy in your current relationship, it's because it is negative. It doesn't mean that you can't transform it and make it more positive, or that you can't transform it and make it a positive relationship. But what it means is that at its current state, it's a negative relationship. That's intellectual. That's not emotionalism. That's a statement. Statements of fact. Okay. If it consistently brings you pain and suffering, you're in a negative relationship. And all of the manifestations of that pain and suffering and how it expresses itself through your partner unto you, or through you unto your partner, or through you and your partner unto the relationship. Conversely, when you're in a positive relationship, you will have a consistent experience of happiness. There's respect in the relationship. There's no levels of abuse. Now, sometimes things may take place, but what happens, or negative things may take place in a relationship, because life is going to do. But the manner in which you process that particular those particular issues, it allows for those particular issues to run their course rather quickly. So it's not consistent and it's not long standing. That's when you know that you're in a positive relationship. There are people who are in relationships right now who they think they're in positive relationships, but there is an issue that they've been struggling with in that relationship for the last 5 years, the last 10 years, the last 15 years. How can we say that that relationship is positive when that particular issue for the last 5, 10, 15 years has brought you consistent suffering? And that's a long time to be suffering. That's a negative relationship. Positive relationships also tend to affirm life moving into the future. So in other words, if you're raising children, then being in a positive relationship, it will tend to empower your children to have much more positive life experiences, because the nature of your relationship as a husband and wife or as a couple, it's positive, and that's going to filter into your children's experience. Now, if your relationship between, you know, the mother and father is negative, it will influence the child's life experience in a negative way. That's how you know that it's a negative relationship. The negative relationships tend to impact children in a negative way and tend to compromise their life experience. Whereas a positive relationship tends to impact children in a positive way and tends to empower them to have a more loving life experience. So these are some of the things that people can look at. You know, is this relationship bringing me happiness? Do I enjoy being with this person? Do we have a life goal that we are both reaching towards? Are we consistently experiencing happiness? Do we have a collective goal that reaches beyond the next 5 months, the next 5 years, the next 10 years, the next 15 years? And do we have a positive vision for our future, positive vision for our children? If you do have those things, it's probable that you're in a positive relationship. If you don't have those things, then it's probable that you're in a negative relationship. So it's very important to make these distinctions because, again, I said it before, people tend to accept negative relationships, and based upon past programming, they assume that that negative relationship is reflective of love and therefore it must be a positive relationship, when in point of fact it's not. And we have to be very careful about that, because we tend to stay in those negative toxic relationships for far too long. We continue to suffer, and then we wonder why we're unhappy.
So how does one leave a negative relationship?
Well, in the first place, they have to identify that the relationship is not to their benefit anymore. And I think there's a lot of people who go in denial about that. You know, they think that somehow the person is going to change, or that there's something that they can do that's going to change that person, or that there's something they can do that's going to change them, and automatically, magically, like in the Disney films, the relationship is now positive again. So there's a lot of denial that people tend to engage in, but also because of so much investments, there's emotional investments, there's financial investments, there's sexual investments, there's also the investment of children. So sometimes these things are kind of used as excuses as to why they don't exit the relationship. But the truth is that we have to be honest intellectually, look at, assess the relationship, who, what, where, why, when, how. Is this relationship benefiting me? Is it benefiting my partner? Is it, does it make me happy? Does it make my partner? Is it bringing suffering into my life? What about my children? You think about all these different things. And if you can define the relationship as being a negative one, now you can at least begin to conceptualize taking the next step. The next step is to begin to strategize. If you do, in fact, need to exit the relationship, what is the best means of exiting this relationship? And it depends on the situation. If you're in a situation where the relationship is not necessarily extremely abusive, but you're unhappy and it can't, and the relationship can't be salvaged, then you may be able to simply have a candid conversation with your partner and then begin to outline, as if you're writing up a contract, the proper means to which you can exit the relationship and they can exit the relationship by, and in the process, minimize any collateral damage. In some cases, however, if you're in a very destructive relationship and your partner is abusive, sometimes the best thing to do is just when you get a chance to pack up and go, okay? But again, you have to assess the situation, case-by-case situation, and define whether or not the relationship is salvageable. If it's not, and you know that you have to exit the relationship, then you begin the process of preparing to exit that relationship. There's financial considerations. There's emotional considerations. There's also intellectual considerations as well, especially if you have children involved. As an example, if you have children involved and the children are in a public education system and you know that at a certain point you're going to exit this marriage or exit the relationship, well, how is that going to impact the child's intellectual development? Does that mean the child has to move from that particular school to a different school? When you exit and you move into your own place, does a child come live with you? There's child custody issues and so forth and so on. So it goes on and on and on. All of these issues need to be considered in advance of making the ultimate decision. But if you know that the relationship is no longer functional and it's not salvageable, then you have to do the right thing. Ideally, you would want your partner to be on the same page with you and you work together to make sure you minimize collateral damage. But if that's not possible, sometimes the best thing to do is simply to cut ties and make your move.
And we're just about to go to break here. How much time do we have, Mike? I guess he didn't hear me. Anyway, what I want to do is... What's that?
Minute.
Okay, what I want to do here is start getting into the attack on families by the media, government, at all. You have anything good? You know, and this is probably something, you know, based on your cyclical media with 9/11, et cetera, this is probably something that would be right up your category to... make another documentary on. I don't know. I don't want to push anything on you there, but you know, that's a big one, and I see it constantly. And you and I had talked the other day about married with children, about, you know, all of this stuff. It's an attack on the family, but they also show men as incompetent, overgrown children, and all of this stuff. You know, the men aren't proper role models, not properly providing. The women, like Peg, or out of control, et cetera. So, you know, what about the attack on family by the media and government? Oh, and there's the break, so hold that thought.
Okay, all right, good.
All right.
Everybody's happy now.
All right, well, before the break, we were talking about the attack on family by the media and government, et cetera. So you were just about to start off. You want to pick up from there?
Yeah, sure. We forgot because we were having a conversation. I wish you could hear that one.
You know, if you want, I can maybe leave some of the conversations in, but I'll just let you go from there.
Okay. Well, what we were getting into before the break was dealing with the topic of the programming that's out there that has had a negative impact in terms of the family institution. But in particular, I think it's an important topic to dissect, too, because we've already talked a lot about, men in the context of male-female relationships and families. But there's also been the steady degradation of what it means to be a man in media. It's been going on for a long time. It's not anything new. It's just that at this point, I think that it has become so extreme and egregious. What comes to mind, because I remember when I was growing up, there was a show that had come out, and some of y'all, it depends on how old you are, it was called Married with Children. And I remember the main character in that, his name was Al, and he had a family, he had a wife, and he had a daughter and a son. And the manner in which he was portrayed as a man was as if he was a buffoon, was not intellectually gifted. He was sitting around watching TV and drinking beer all the time and had his hands in his crotch and all this kind of thing. It became an archetype. And again, this was a very popular show. And so there were a lot of people who were viewing this, and there was a lot of males who began to think and graft that particular archetype into their own sensibilities as it relates to their aspirations toward becoming men. That's a serious problem, because when you take the levels of intellectualism that a man can contribute to a family or to a relationship out of the equation, you're setting the family up, and you're setting the children up, and in point of fact, you're setting the woman up for different levels of dysfunction. A man's ability to use his intellectual faculties to solve problems is key. And I'll tell you, men out there, I'll let you all know right now, the amount of problems that you have right now in your life, if you're single, cannot compare to the amount of problems that will come up once you are in a relationship. And the amount of problems that you have when you're in a relationship, they will pale in comparison to the amount of problems that will arise once you begin to have children. Now, problems are going to present themselves. That's an aspect of life. But as a man, how you manage those problems is directly related to your intellectual capacity, meaning how you're able to figure out, using your mind, proper solutions. Now, if you're given an archetype for, you know, such a long time, we've been given this archetype, we meet it for a long time. Another example would be the Simpsons and Homer Simpson and his archetype, what he represented. If you're given these types of archetypes, what it means to be a man, you're given to it at a very early age and you're very impressionable, that's going to adversely impact the vision that you have for yourself as a man. And ultimately, you may engage in behaviors that compromise your intellectual faculties, intellectual faculties being key to your ability to solve problems that will arise as you get into a relationship and ultimately you begin to start your family. So this type of programming, and I'm sure you can probably provide a lot more examples, because we can go down a whole list of, it could be a television show, it could be movies, it could be even music that we listen to, provides us with these very low levels of low-level archetypes for what it means to be a man. And as a consequence, we may aspire to becoming something much less than what we can become. And when we become something much less than what we can become, we ultimately set ourselves up for dysfunctional male-female relationships and broken family institutions. So the propaganda that's out there is often designed to put men in a state of arrested development, to where they are thinking on junior high school levels. And if you're thinking on junior high school levels, how are you going to manage the life experience that experiences that occur when you actually become a man? Very important for us to look at. So I'm very clear, whenever I see programming out there that portrays men in a very negative light, that portrays men as buffoons and you know, these individuals who have low levels of intellect, I recognize that programming for what it is, and I do not allow that to become the archetype that I am aspiring towards as an intellectual being who has the capacity to solve problems, not just for myself, but for my wife and for my children.
Well said, and we'll be back right after this. 800-313-9443 if anybody wants to call in and speak to Lennon. We'll be right back.
No more thinking! No more thinking! Everybody's happy now.
Okay, I think we're back now. And, let's see. You know, we touched on extended family earlier. Did you want to add anything regarding extended family as a social structure?
Yes. What I would like to say, because this is another consideration that we do have to have, because in my wife's, our situation is quite unique, because we live a lifestyle that is more in line with self-empowerment. So what I mean by that is we, you know, we homeschool, we homebirth, we feed our own children, we educate our own children. We don't spank or hit or maim or any of that stuff. We don't abuse our children in any way. We tend to intellectualize things with them. We talk with them a lot, and we're with them like 24 hours a day, literally. So part of what I want to get at is that for those of us who do decide to do things a little bit differently than what has been established by the extended family as a socialized norm, it is important for us to not compromise on what we know needs to be done for our children for the sake of the extended family. In other words, it's the extended family's job to support us. It's not our job to capitulate and try to transform what we're doing to fit within the mold of what's comfortable for our extended family. Well, the reason I'm saying that is because my wife and I, we're like 14 years into our relationship, and our oldest son is 11 years old now. So we've had over a decade of this type of thing. In the beginning, we did receive a lot of resistance from our extended family, who tend to be more in line with what most people in America, how they live their life and how we've kind of been indoctrinated into living life. Now, there's many different ways of living life. No way I would say is somehow superior to the other one. What I'm saying is that the diversity in terms of how we choose to live our lives as individuals or as, you know, a couple or what have you, even as a family dynamic, that needs to be respected. I just want people to understand that when we talk about our extended family, it's important that they have a level of respect for how you are choosing to raise your children or how you're choosing to engage in your relationship. And they should be supportive of that, even if how you're choosing to raise your children isn't in line with how they are choosing to raise their children. So to maintain that level of mutual respect is very important. My wife and I, we're not big on telling other people that they need to homeschool or home birth. Most people don't even know that. We don't necessarily share that with a lot of people. We have done videos on the top in the past, but it doesn't become a major thing that we present and speak about over and over and over again. That is because we respect everyone's right to live the life that they seek to live. What we would hope for people to do is to live the best life that they can live and then respect other people's ability to live the best life that they can live. So just be clear about this, that the extended family has a role and it's important. But if the extended family is not in line with the progressions that you're taking in your life, there's nothing wrong with either limiting the amount of interaction that you have with your extended family or at the very least restructuring the relational model to where they you talk with them, and you have intelligent conversations with them so that they will have enough respect for you and what you're doing with your own family institution. That's a very important point that I've learned over the years.
And, you know, we should also take into consideration the extended family in this country has really been conditioned into the state needs to do everything. What do you mean you're homeschooling? What do you mean you're doing this or doing that? You know, what do you mean you don't spank your children? And speaking of spanking, it was like a day or 2 days after my son's third birthday, we were down in Peru. And we're in the hostel and he just has a meltdown. He's having a tantrum. He's running all over the place. And looking back, it was probably because his aunt had given him a candy bar. But he was just he was just completely out of control. And so my ex and I, you know, this is when we were together. We sit him down in our room and we're like, look, you know, if you don't settle down, we're going to spank you. And we hadn't ever spanked him before he was three. And by the way, you know, I started getting spanked when I was like 1.5 or something, just completely ridiculous.
Mm-hmm, yeah,
but,
yeah.
But you know, so we sit him down and we're like, look, this is what's going to happen if you continue. And he still continued, gets in hand. So I said, okay, on the count of five, I'm going to spank you. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, I whop him in the butt and he turns around and he clocks me in the face. And I just said, wow, you know, that's a really good instinct. That was a self-defense instinct. That's what he naturally should have done. And so it just, you know, it really dawned on me right then and there that spanking didn't work, you know. And I think, you know, one time he threw a huge rock at a car and, you know, I may have screamed and swatted him once then too. But and that was at three also, but those were the only two instances. And, looking back, you know, it was just wow, and his response to it was satisfactory. You know, I mean, if you spank your children, folks, and they spank you back, they hit you back. You know, if someone hits you in public, you have the right to hit them back. Hello, it's called self-defense. So a three-year-old gets that. And so, you know, when he was three, I came across this book called 1, 2, 3 Magic. I think my buddy has. I don't see it sitting on the shelf over there. But this book was really helpful. And what you just count to three. And for every year old that the child is, you give him a 1 minute timeout. And, you know, since he was three or four, maybe like 4.5-ish, he never got in trouble again. And, you know, and he's in things like karate. He's very focused. He just got his yellow belt last week, et cetera. He's really stoked about that. But, you know, the key thing that a lot of parents don't understand is that your children have to trust you. If you say you're going to do something, you do it. If you say, okay, if you do that again, there's going to be repercussions and you're going to go on timeout. You don't sit there, okay, well, the next time you do it, you're going to go, well, one more time. And you see these retarded nanny shows on TV, and this is the problem that these parents have almost every time, is their children don't trust their parents at all. Well, and aside from the crappy diet and sugar and wheat and all that stuff, but the children don't trust them at all. And you'll see these parents sit there, you know, they'll spank their kids and, you know, I'm going to put you on timeout. You do that one more time, and then 10 times later, they still haven't done anything. Here's the issue. You don't need to spank. You don't need to hit. You don't need to use violence. You need to say, look, if you're going to use that behavior, Here are the repercussions for doing so. Oh, right. you don't like that behavior. Well, guess what? And, you know, so, you know, when he was 4 or 5, you know, every once in a while I would get to 1 or 2 when I count, you know. I think maybe once in the last 2 years I got to 3 and he had like an 8-minute timeout. But it totally solved any issues. And, you know, people come up to me, you know, your son is so well behaved. You know, my son will be in the post up, will be at the post off at the store or something, and be like, mm-hmm. you know, he'll mm-hmm. see other kids just completely out of control and be like, Dad, what is wrong with those kids? I said, well, you know, the parents give them a bad diet and the children don't trust their parents. And so this is what they're doing. And my son is, you know, he's 9 now and he's just, wow. You know,
that's right. That's right. And that key thing, trust, that trust is something that has to be built up over time. And parents have to be consistent. Like if you're not consistent, like you said, if you say you're going to do something, you do it. Because children, if they can't trust you, they won't respect you. And if they won't respect you, then they will run wild.
I agree. You know what? And I forgot there was we have a caller online. You want to take a call?
Yeah, sure.
All right. Let's go to Sovereign Man. You there?
Greetings and salutations, gentlemen. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Yeah, and it's nice to hear children playing in the background. They're learning.
Oh, you can hear the babies? I don't even know. I have on headphones.
Oh, yeah. Actually, it's an honor to be on call with Mr. Honor. And I'm sorry that I didn't have the opportunity to meet you at the last conference. Yeah, I'm willing. Maybe we'll get to meet sometime in the future, maybe in April.
Yeah, I hope so.
I don't know if you're scheduled or not, but hopefully. Actually, you guys are right on point. Children definitely need consistency. You know, they need your language to be proved out in your action.
Yes. Well,
by the way, I wanted to let you know that I came to knowledge of you and your work through the hip hop, the Hidden Hand, and the Emasculation of the Black Man. That was an excellent series that you did. And I would recommend Jan to maybe have you back on for maybe doing a show on that.
Well, you know, I was actually planning on hoping to cover some of that. You know, and I've been, maybe we'll have Curtis Duncan back on again, too, but it's not just the emasculation of Black men. We're seeing it across the board.
Yeah, that was the beginning. Hip-hop right. was the beginning, and then it proliferated worldwide.
Yeah, I think they used the Black community as the test, and then they moved it across the board to... you know, and now I actually see the white family as one of the key targets at the current present. I don't know if Lennon would agree with that or not, but, you know, I'm seeing it rampant across the board right now.
Well, we see it everywhere. We see it everywhere. One of the reasons why I specifically focus in on this particular aspect taking place amongst African American folk is because it hits so very, very close to home, and I've seen it play itself out over and over and over again, especially in the music. You all will be surprised at how many males I grew up with who, once they began to deal with the music, there was already like the television shows, there was the movies, Boys in the Hood, Menace to Society, but the music. And when I talk about the movies, black exploitation films, that's the generation before mine. So there's been this longstanding propaganda campaign to destabilize the notion of what it means to be an honorable man, and in particular, what it means to be an honorable African American man. And I've seen this play itself out not only in my own life, the types of influence that I've had, but also many other African American males. And there were males that I grew up with who lived perfectly peaceful lives and were well on their way to experiencing a wonderful life experience, but then once they got a hold of listening to particular types of hip hop, you see the steady degradation on so many different levels. How they spoke, how they dressed, how they presented themselves, how they respected women began to change. This is social engineering through this degree of programming. Now, the thing is this, that it doesn't mean that it's only been specific to African American males. The truth of the matter is that this is an ongoing onslaught against what it means to be a man. And that's why we need to take a critical look at that and be clear about the programming that exists out there. This is the other thing I just want for the caller, because he brought up my previous documentary documentary work, lecture series, Hip Hop, The Hidden Hand, Degradation of Black Masculinity, one of the things that I learned from that particular experience is that when you begin to display and exhibit scientifically with evidence and proof, okay, we're talking about coming from the vantage point, thinking, proper intellectual process, research. When you begin to expose the truth that African-American males in particular have been led astray in terms of what they perceive to be masculinity, there are a lot of African-American males who begin to take offense. Now, what I'm alluding to here is that the programming is so deep that the people who are being programmed, they will go to the extremes to defend the programming, even when the programming itself isn't functional for them and it's destructive to their everyday life. So this is why this particular issue of dissecting this type of programming, whether we put it within the scope of African-American experience or just the world in general in terms of the programming for men, it's important to dissect this critically.
You know, Lennon, based on what you were just talking about, you know, I had Bodie Sanders on the show 3 times who discusses honorable men. So I highly recommend you check out those shows. I think you'll find a lot of great interest for your own work there. But also this, what is now 5 parts recorded, this 5-part, it's probably going to be 6 or 7-part series with Dr. Hans Utter on music, mind control, and psychobiology. And he focuses a lot on hip-hop. But again, you know, we see with the 60s counterculture, this was actually targeting the middle-class family as well as men, and, you know, the communes, the communitarianism. But we see this heavily, the same thing with hip-hop and rap music. We see the same degradation and attack on women, you know, or the views on men changing about women from heavy metal, from the death metal and all of this stuff, all of these Satanists, like in Satanity and all of this stuff going on out there. But, you know, so anyway, this... These 2 series, I think, will add a lot or provide a lot of additional information on that. And, you know, we still have weeks to go before we're even done with the music series.
Yes. Another thing I want to mention, too, is that there have been collaborative efforts between rap artists at particular junctures and a heavy metal artist. There's a particular term, I can't read the genre, it's not heavy metal, there's a particular genre. But the thing is that there's also been the infusion of the Run-DMC in particular.
Right.
I think that's Run-DMC.
And Aerosmith, been, right.
Yes, Aerosmith. There's been an infusion of the sonic landscape that is present in heavy metal music, which actually happens to disrupt the normal functioning of the human body. The inclusion of that sonic landscape, meaning the tones and frequencies
exactly
that are being used, and it's been infused into hip-hop as well. So not only do you have that dynamic taking place in terms of sonically, but then you also have the lyrical composition, which is very destructive, very demeaning, demoralizing, disrespectful towards women in particular, also disrespectful to men, and also from those negative racial stereotypes, on and on and on. I give examples of all of this, but also the sonic landscape really sets up a very potent cocktail to establish and to manipulate people to such a degree to wherein African-American men and males in particular begin to engage in levels of behavior modification that become extremely destructive. And point of fact, my next documentary, NWA, which stands for Niggas with Attitudes, a Critical Analysis, will dissect this particular theme at length. And that's my current project. And I want to encourage people to check out my YouTube page because I am doing updates on that particular project each week.
All right. Well, I'll definitely have to check that out. And you know what? We're probably not even going to get through. We probably finished about half these questions. You know, so if you're interested, we can probably have you come back maybe next week sometime, and we can cover the rest of this stuff and go into more on the hip hop, because what you just described sounds exactly like what Dr. Hans Utter and I are going into.
Yes. This is a major project. I'm still in the research phase in data collection, but I also plan on, that includes reading biographies of NWA members, also researching online, of course. I will be doing interviews, too, with particular individuals. So this is going to be one of my major documentaries. Now, I have quite a few on LennonOnAFilm.com, but this particular documentary is going to be a major, major work, and it's well on its way, and I'm looking forward to getting this one done, because a lot of what we're talking about here, we can see the influence that hip-hop has had to create this functional male-female relationships, but also to destabilize the family unit. But then also, because we've been talking about this more recently in this in our discussion here, how it has also promoted the degradation of Black masculinity, but also masculinity in general when we talk about the world worldwide, because this the phenomenon in terms of NWA and their lyrical content, it also went global. So there were a lot of males all over the world, doesn't matter what color of your skin or quote-unquote ethnic background or what have you, were influenced by this, and it sets a very poor precedence in terms of what it means to be a man, what it means to be a father, what it means to be a husband, and what it means to be an individual who is willing to think critically and transcend the paradigm that has caused so much suffering in
Yeah. And that's the bumper music right there. So we're going to have to go to a break. But let me know if you want me to put you in touch with Dr. Rutter if you like the work, and we'll be right back. All right, we're back. We only have a few minutes left here before we wrap it up. Did you want to take one more call there, Lennon?
Yeah, sure.
All right, let's go to Fred in Iowa. Hey, Fred.
Yeah, well, I just dialed in. You know, we've all been programmed. We've all been brainwashed. But Black people that are informed and knowledgeable, they can help their brothers and sisters. And that will create less division among us. That same applies to white. And when we understand more and what it is to be a man and what it is to be a woman, then we can start helping our brothers and sisters, irrespective of color. And I think we could grow if that could happen. Thank you, man. Have a good time. Bye.
You're welcome, Fred, and good night. You know, and... to that point, you know, like I mentioned on last night's radio show, folks, is that, you know, what does a prison warden do? His job is essentially to keep the prisoners divided and conquered, because if the prisoners start working together, if they started organizing each other and all of this stuff, they could probably get out of prison in a day or two. But like on the human ranch with all of the track home farms everywhere, this is how they manage us, keep us divided and conquered. You have the rap music and the hip-hop, and then you've got the death metal, and you've got the Deadheads, and you've got, you know, all of these different sub-genres of music and pop culture and everything that keeps everybody divided and separate. And that's, you know, really the point of them doing that.
No, I agree, and the caller really kind of sums up the message here, especially when we talk about being men, that it's going to take men to change things. Of course, women play a role too, but in particular, men really understanding what it means to be a man. And part of what it means to be a man is to look beyond all of the divisive tactics that are being employed to keep us at war with each other as men. That's why I think it's important for us to be able to come together as men and have these types of conversations, because it sets a precedence that reaches beyond the previous paradigm. And then it also begins to filter into our male-female relationships and our family institutions. So I want to thank the caller for bringing that up. It's so very true.
All right. We have about a minute left here. Did you have anything else you want to add? You want to touch on pornography for about 20 or 30 seconds, and maybe we can have you back in a couple of weeks to go into depth on some more of these issues?
Oh, yeah, let's get into that the next time you come on. Because I'm days on that topic. This was the quickest 2 hours I've had on a radio interview, and I can't remember the last time I had it this quick of a 2 hours. I really enjoyed the conversation, man.
Yeah. Well, you know, and I just interviewed Dr. E. Michael Jones as well as Gary Wilson on porn over the last couple of weeks on the show, too, covering those issues. So... right up there. So I think it would be an excellent, add-on to the discussion for next time. So, Lennon, you want to give out, again, your YouTube channel, website, any books you have or working on, et cetera?
Yeah, sure. Real quickly, my website, of course, is lennonhonor.com. All of my books are listed there. I also have all of my documentary work on lennonhonorfilms.com. I'm on YouTube under Lennon Honor Films, and I'm also on Facebook under Lennon Honor. Make sure y'all head on over to my YouTube page and check out my series NWA, A Critical Analysis, but then also check out my series, The 911 Fear-Based Mind control programming. Some things of great interest I'm sure people will find benefiting. And I want to thank you again, brother, for having me on the show. As always, it's been a pleasure. And also thank the studio tech. Thank him for all of his efforts here today. I had a wonderful, wonderful time.
Thank you. And ladies and gentlemen, that was the bumper music that just started up. And we'll have you back again in a couple weeks, Lennon. Thank you so much. And it definitely went by quickly. Have a good night, folks. See you tomorrow.